Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of February 2020. Welcome to episode 57 of this podcast series. The concept of the show is to just have a brief chat about what comics I've read since the last time we had one of these brief chats, which should make this pretty much the comics I read during February. These books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost them on my Facebook and Twitter, so you can find those. And by the way, since February had 5 Saturdays, this is going to be an extra long episode, just so you know. But first, a little feedback. Sir Martin of Grey, posted a question to me on Twitter, and it more or less fits here, so I thought I'd take a shot at answering it. Professor Allen, as a kid, I could never understand DC's "we have to put the price up by 10 cents, but to make things less sad, we're adding up to 16 pages of reprints." Could they have not increased the price by half that, say, and kept the mags the same size? Does anyone understand the business logic of this? I responded with a couple of points, and it's probably a combination. The marketing is probably easier if you add 10 cents to the price and give extra content, as opposed to increasing it by only 5 cents and giving nothing extra. That's probably the harder sell. And in terms of profit margin, that's probably a matter of fixed costs and variable costs, or maybe more precisely, marginal costs. That is, the additional costs you have to pay to print a larger version of the comic book. The additional cost of adding 4 more sheets of paper, going from 8 to 12, which would be 32 pages to 48 pages. It does add the price of the paper, but a lot of the fixed printing costs, like the setup fee for a new press run, all of your leasing costs, depreciation costs, salaries, those costs are the same no matter how many pages the book has in it. And the costs of the reprint issues, the reprint stories, are probably pretty minor, especially in that era when residuals and royalties were both pretty low, if they existed at all. So those are not answers that I'm sure of, but those are my educated hypotheses in terms of answering Martin's question. We also heard from Michael T. Geist, who reported that he just grabbed issues 2 and 3 of Mystic You, a book I covered here last month, and he did so at a terrific sale. My LCS, The Comics Place, had a 2-day customer appreciation sale. The sale included a fill a box for $10 area. I was able to fit 123 comics in the box, so that works out to about 8 cents per comic. That is my kind of deal. The books were pulled from over 30 long and short boxes of random comics. The second day included 20 to 50% off most merchandise in the whole shop, and I picked up some first print trades. Altogether, a fun, geeky weekend, and I want to share the great deals I found here in my part of the Northwest. Again, thanks for the informative and entertaining podcast. You're welcome, Michael. And just so you know, Michael did confirm that he is not planning to start the 8 Cent Comics podcast. And that was a relief, because we can still be friends this way. A nice score, buddy. I love comic sales, even the ones that are 3,000 miles away from me. Manuel Carmona of Truthful Comics and Comics for Christmas shared the episode saying that we were one of his favorite podcast networks. Clinton Robinson made this dramatic comment: "If there's no Lil Jinx in this episode, I demand a refund." I actually made Clinton the same offer I make this to all listeners. I will send you back double the cost of this episode if you just mail me your receipt and some comics, okay? I just think that's good, reasonable customer service. And we heard from our newest member of the roundtable, Sir Luke Giaconetti. Professor, first off, let me thank you for the field commendation. The honor is all mine. I vow to continue to serve with the same dedication to thriftiness, obscurity, and downright ridiculousness which has defined our time together. Finally, someone who truly understands what the roundtable is about. That adaptation of The Deep was an interesting one for me, as I have not actually ever seen the movie. Heck, I've never even read the novel. From the comic, it looks like a fun maritime adventure. I do like the cover emphasizing the dangerous undersea life, which plays a minor role in the overall story, but does do a better job of saying, hey, this is from the guy that wrote Jaws, which I imagine was the point. Yes, Luke, that was certainly the point. Conan, The Road of Kings was a good read as well. I have to say that I was very surprised to see classic Conan comics scribe Roy Thomas's name in the credits box. But Thomas obviously knows the character very well, and even given the harsher style of the Dark Horse books, he does a great job on the Cimmerian, even in this atypical story. Marvel recently did a spate of Conan and related imprints as part of their True Believer line, and those were all well worth the $1 price tag. Additionally, Dark Horse did publish a few series featuring another Howard creation, Cull, including a wonderful adaptation of The Shadow Kingdom, my favorite Cull story. Again, recommend them if you can. Complete agreement, Luke, on Conan and Roy Thomas. That's just a great match. And I do need to read some Cull. That is also good advice. Thanks again, Luke says, for relating and arranging the varied funny books that you read in January. I always look forward to hearing the sheer variety, the width of the titles, which make it through your to-read pile each month. Sir Luke of the Upstate. And it's always good to hear from you, sir. And we heard from half of our rad listeners of the year, Count Darren Sutherland. Hi, Professor Allen. I had a great time today listening to your January reading journal. I must say that the emails from Mike Bailey and Luke Giaconetti made me smile. I'm consistently amazed how we've been able to trick so many people into thinking we're nice. Obviously, Ruth and I missed our callings. We should probably have gone into acting or politics. Seriously, though, hearing kind comments like that from genuinely nice people like Mike and Luke warms my heart. The friends we've made through the comics and podcast communities are truly a blessing, and we're thankful every day for those friendships. That's the nice and honest person in me saying thank you for your friendships, Alan, Michael, and Luke. Moving on to your fun episode, I must say, I have that comic adaptation of The Deep in my collection from when it was first released. I've always liked that movie and eagerly bought the comic. I should reread it and maybe rewatch the film too. I enjoyed hearing your thoughts about the Alf comics. I always enjoyed that TV series, but never got into any of the spin-offs like the cartoons or the comics. And your comments about Image being better when you can't read the dialogue made me laugh so hard I disturbed other people on the bus this morning. Thanks for a great episode, as always, Darren. Disturbing people on public transportation? We call that mission accomplished. That last episode received social media love from Luke and Gene Hendricks from the Two True Freaks podcast network, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Billy D from Into the Weird, Mike from Comics in the Golden Age, Karen from Between the Pages, James Williams from Karen, Paul from the Collected Edition, Derek William Crabb from the History of Comics on Film, Fan Films Friday, Bill Jordan, Chris Willett, and We Love Comics. Thanks for that support, everybody. And now, on to the books that I read last month, and as we do on this show, we categorize the books. And first of the issues that I read specifically for podcast appearances, and I see that Podcasting's Michael Bailey has begun to use this nomenclature as well, with proper attribution, thank you. We start with the homework books. For Quarterbin 149, I read Marvel Superheroes Magazine number 5. And for Quarterbin 150, I read Defenders 99. And of course, on the national holiday, February 5th, Doomsday 0.5, I picked up the book I talked about on the most recent episode of Doomspeak, Doctor Doom number 5. And then, these next ones are Quarterbin follow-ups, following up from recent episodes with Topps Kirbyverse books, Satan's 6, 1 and 2, and the Secret City Saga 1, 3 and 4. And that means that I've now read 9 of the 12 issues in that entire line. And I'm glad that I have. They weren't great. I'm not saying that. But for an easily assembled world of comics to collect, these are really cheap. And they're also pretty good. There's a nice reveal in the last issue that changed the premise a little bit. And that was enjoyable. I've gotten a few of these from quarter bins, some from 50-cent boxes. I possibly paid as much as a buck for a couple of them. And if I ever find the last three, I'll definitely read them as well. The Secret City books were drawn by Steve Ditko, and that was a nice bonus. His work always works for me. And comics I read for listening to podcasts. And there are more of these than usual, because DC Universe app. And I love following along with comic book podcasts when I have the chance, and the existence of that app gives me more opportunities to have that chance. For listening along with Laurel and her crew on episode 26 of the Hunters podcast, I read Direct from the 1970s. Batman Family 17, a storyline where the Earth 2, Helena Wayne, heads to Earth 1 to meet her not exactly dad, Bruce Wayne, and ends up getting into crime-fighting shenanigans with Kathy Kane and Barbara Gordon. For listening along with episode 30 of Shags, Justice League International podcast, I read Justice League America 30 and Justice League Europe 60. To listen along with Mike Peacock's Justice's First Dawn, I read Justice League of America 117. It sounds like Mike is going to hang up the mic for a while, at least for this show, and I'm certainly going to miss that. Come back to podcasting when you can, Brother Peacock. We'd be glad to hear from you. And for the return of From Crisis to Crisis, co-hosted by Podcasting's Michael Bailey, with episode 228, I read Adventures of Superman 529 and Superman 106, part of the Trial of Superman storyline. The show Back to the Bins continued their semi-regular coverage of an interesting series, and I followed along by reading JSA Strange Adventures 3 and 4. I'm liking this. It's a golden age adventure of the JSA with a strong backstory or background of the pulp publishing magazines of the era. And then on to new comics that we read right off the shelves. Dial H for Hero number 11. We are in the Reign of the Super Miguels era, although the four of them quickly get Y-dialed into basically Superman Blue and the Shazam Captain Marvel, and that was a nice look. We also get the recovery of the K-dial, meaning that the bad guy can use all four dials to dial the ultimate magic number, F-I-F-T-Y-T-W-O. which is hilarious, and which is also deadly, as Mr. Thunderbolt Sakamaji is set next issue to reboot all of history, all of reality, and all of time. Justice League Dark 19. This one does finally wrap up the Witching Hour storyline, which I have not been totally enamored with. Not a lot of action in this issue, which by itself doesn't have to be a bad thing, but it sort of wraps up in a kind of a weak manner. I have hopes for the next storyline, but am keeping the title on a short leash for now. And from the good folks at Alterna, providers of new comics at the awesome price of $1.50, I wrapped up a mini-series by reading Midnight Mystery City of Ghosts 3 and 4. So the story of Zeke King and the zombies and other mysteries comes to a close, or at least this story does. What this does well is use the Alterna limitations to its best. The nature of the newsprint paper means that the coloring can't be as bright as other comics, and sometimes even the reproduction itself doesn't end up completely clear. So what Bernie Gonzalez does here is have a lot of 3 or 4 panel pages, some 5 or 6, but very few, if any, more than that, which does help the art stay good in the format for these Alterna books, because you're not trying to reproduce details in very small spaces that might not be effective, again, with the reproduction on this quality of paper. So it's very smart, very sort of well thought out. The story aspect of this one was okay. I like the resolution, and I'm certainly intrigued by the prospect of the next storyline, which may involve Dracula. And I read the last issue of a current mini featuring one of my all-time favorite characters, Lady Mechanica Sangre number 5. That, if you don't remember, is Sangre as in blood, as in vampires, speaking of Dracula. The main story is that Lady M has been hired to protect a teenage boy from the bad influences in his life, and those bad influences are vampires, although the boy's father considers them demons. It's a good story, it's good art, I love this character, and the only little blip that bumped me right at the end was that the theme was hammered home way too strongly in the last couple of pages, but that's a pretty small quibble. I just like that to be a little more subtle than what we got here right at the very end. And I hear that a new Lady M story is going to come out again this summer or start this summer. And if that's the case, I will certainly be buying it. And this is one that I just wrapped up from Hoopla. It's a new ongoing title that just wrapped up, Dr. Mirage, number 5. And as we always say around here, endings are hard. And this ending was pretty good. This is the story of a widowed woman who had a Talk to the Dead TV show back when her husband was alive. And they wrapped this plot up. We learned some things. But mostly the issue was itself a meditation on death and on memory and on meaning, and was very solid. Although, of course, they did leave a loose end or two that a future volume could pick up on if another volume does come along. And another current series that I've been reading, issue by issue on Hoopla, also wrapped up along with Dr. Mirage, and this was Archie, The Married Life 10 Years Later, number 6. This, like I said, wraps up the series, although I'm not convinced we've seen the last of these characters or these versions from these timelines. Dilton comes to the rescue of the characters in both universes, rescuing them from the stresses of adulthood and reminding everybody that friendship holds the multiverse together, and that love is best when it springs from a depth of friendship. Good messages all the way around, and not a bad way to end a miniseries in an Archie comic. Fun way to revisit the married life universes. And on to general comic reading that I did. From the big boxes of books sent in by the generous Canadian Rob Lance, I read a novel tie-in from Dell Comics from 1968, Gentle Ben, number 2. This is the story of a man who works at the Florida Wildlife Agency, and his son has a tamed pet bear. That is Gentle Ben, and you can think of him as a 500-pound lassie. Actually, not bad stories, I have to say. Rob also sent a coverless Charlton book, Korg, 70,000 BC, number 1 from 1975. As prehistoric series go, it was okay. It was a Hanna-Barbera property, and I'm not sure if that was the reason, but the plot was pretty simplistic. From the great Kansan, Greg Arujo, I read Patsy and Hetty, 77. And it was interesting. Somewhere between a romance story and an Archie book. It didn't work for me as well as I thought it might. I know they aren't exactly comparable, but I much more enjoyed the Millie the Model issue that I read last year in terms of a book sort of trying to live in that space. Sure, I was Joe, sent in some comics a while back, and from that pile, I read Captain America 342. This is when Cap is in the black suit, working with Falcon, D-Man, Nomad, and others out in California. In this one, Viper takes her serpent-themed villains, and they take on the existing Serpent Society, who call in Cap and his team for help. It's a good story, but my favorite part of reading this was seeing all the ads for comic book stores and conventions. This is a book from 1988, and that is about that transition period, right when we're getting to see the start of that type of advertising. Joe also sent the very interesting Birthright, number 8 from Skybound/Image. This is a case of a book in a world that seems interesting, but that looking at a single issue of, I couldn't quite grasp. But the imagery, including the pregnant lady with the angel wings, was striking, and I am intrigued by the book. He also sent Bloodshot number 1 from just a few months ago. Not a bad book and not a bad character. In this version, he's a little bit Punisher, a little bit Wandering Samurai. That was interesting. Joe also sent Eclipso 13, of which the highlight for me was the presence of the Creeper. Although, spoilers, the ending of the issue is not such a happy one for the Creeper or for any of the other heroes who try to make a stand against Eclipso. But it was the 90s, so of course the bad guy was going to win. And from Brenda, the Crazy Cat Lady, I read Gold Key Spotlight number 9, featuring Trog and the Sky Gods. Now this one had more of a 40s or 50s feel, with dinosaurs and prehistoric weapons, but also bad guys with jetpacks. They were the Sky Gods. This one was surprisingly strong, with a nice narrative feature of having the top 3/4 or so of each page tell our main story, while the bottom section of each page tracked the progress of a huge shark, actually sort of getting into the shark's perspective. And that continues till the very end, when the stories converge in an action-packed and bloody way. I mean, there was a shark involved. Very enjoyable, very interesting book. Derek William Crabb sent in a big box of comics as a Christmas present, including Shadowhawk number 2 from Image from 1992. The highlight was the 2-page appearance of Spawn, who had a quick discussion with Shadowhawk, and since Shadowhawk convinced Spawn that he was in fact the good guy, Spawn let him continue to do his thing. Derek also sent, also from Image, Ballistic Imagery, a one-shot anthology title, with stories featuring Hellcop, Heavy Space, and True Stories of the Cyberforce. I don't know if these were meant to be pilot episodes of potential series, looking for reader feedback if any one of these caught on particularly well. or if it was just a spot to showcase three vaguely sci-fi comic concepts. And two of the three stories were quite good, actually. I had no idea what to expect, but quite enjoyed it. And direct from the New 52, he sent Green Lantern New Guardians number 2, in which Kyle Rayner has attracted all of the colored rings around him, and he flees to Oa to hear from the Guardians about this. But he has all of the other Rainbow Lanterns after him, too. There are aspects and runs of Green Lantern that I like, but this title, this version, generally not my fave. And from something called Spectrum Comics, Derek also sent The Guardian, number 2. I read a lot of indie books from this era, and many of them were better than this. This one had weirdly inconsistent coloring, and to me, coloring and lettering is always one of those ways that you can see a sense of amateurishness in a comic. He also sent The Coven, number 1 from Awesome, and X7 from Dark Horse, both from the heart of the 90s. The Coven was mostly an excuse for putting lady characters in skimpy costumes, while the other was over-the-top action with heaven and hell aspects, sort of a Spawn wannabe. And despite the lack of lady characters in skimpy costumes, I think I liked that one more. And Big Five Army, Kirk Spencer, sent in a few books recently, including The Fade Out number 1 by Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips. There's a murder in old-time Hollywood, a young starlet, following a wild party. But not everyone wants the truth to come to light. Brubaker has proven many times that he knows how to write crime and mystery and noir stories, that's for sure. And I've heard good things about this one. So it was good to read this first issue of this series, and I'm intrigued enough that I may look up some of the others as well. From the Dollar Box, at Journey into Comics, I picked up Secret Origins Annual number 1, featuring a Paul Kupperberg and John Byrne version of the Doom Patrol origin. This was not an exciting story. It was a lot of talky talk. But the team's history up until 1987 was pretty interesting, and I like the team, so I sort of like that story. The second one, Captain Comet, had actually a similar feel to it. Lots of talking, lots of words, but not a lot of action. But again, it's always good to see Captain Comet get some page real estate in a comic book. And also for a dollar from the Dollar Comics basement at Pack Rat Comics, I read Weird Western 44 from 1978, a novel-length story about Scalp Hunter. And that character's premise, not being at home in either the native or white man society, keeps the series relevant, and the story's pretty good, you know, despite the occasional bits of what we would see today as insensitivity. From the 50-cent bin, the Pulp Reality, I picked up a DC one-shot I had never heard of before, but it was extra-sized. So, of course, I had to pick up 1996's Detention Comics. It's had three individual stories starring Robin, Superboy, and Guy Gardner-Warrior, all in settings or situations that were school-related. My favorite was probably Guy Gardner as a substitute teacher in a high school where students have been developing powers. But I am probably going to talk about one of the other stories on a podcast later in the year. That's all I can say for now. And from the 3-for-1 boxes at Carolina Comics and More, I read Fantastic Four Unlimited number 2 from 1993. I like the Inhumans. That was the pull for this issue. Obviously, it wasn't the FF that had me interested. This was the era of Sue's cutout uniform, and that was not a great idea. And there was a distinct lack of Dr. Doom in this issue. And that's also never a good thing. I also picked up a book from my brother-in-law, a big Star Trek fan, but it turns out he already had this one, so I just read it myself. And that was Star Trek Deep Space Nine Annual Number One from Malibu. It's a Mike W. Barr story. It had a mystery at its root, and Barr writes that type of story very well. It's also an alternate universe story, so a good read all the way around. And some kids' books that I read, mostly from Sir Rob's care package, but also a few from Iowa's Joe. I read Fat Albert, 2, 15 and 26, Betty and Me, 38 and 50, Riverdale Comics Digest, 7, Wendy's Witch World, 25, Richie Rich Fortunes, 12, 25 and 30, Reggie and Me, 114, Laugh, 333, and Walt Disney's Donald Duck, 252, 256, 258, and 279. And yes, a few of those Donald Duck issues contained full-length international epic adventures by Carl Barks. In one, the Ducks go to the land of Volcanavia for reasons. And in one, Scrooge dispatches them to track down the world's only unicorn. Epic adventures and always a bunch of fun. All right, time to take a break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about the graphic novels, trade paperbacks, and long runs that I read in February.
Hey everybody, Clinton Robinson here. I recently attempted to sneak into the Longbox Crusade headquarters basement to watch some of the Albrecht Brothers action movies while the crew was out at the Saturday matinee theater. Too bad I had a little mishap and got stuck down here, with no movies to boot. However, there are pieces of Pat's old podcasting equipment and excellent Wi-Fi service, so I decided to pass the time watching online fan films and talking about them. What, you don't know what a fan film is? Well, there are these non-theatrical movies that people post online of already established characters and settings. Hey, now. Just wait and see. Save all judgment for what happens when you listen to Fan Film Fridays, a new podcast found on the Longbox Crusade podcast feed.
And we're back. Talk about trades, long runs, and miniseries that I read last month. And from our reigning listeners of the year, the mighty Sutherlands, there are a few trades of Edgar Rice Burroughs-related properties that they gave when we hung out around Christmas. Starting with a collection of The Land That Time Forgot 1 through 3 and Sita the Savage 1 and 2 from 2016 from American Mythology. I haven't read any of the Castback novels starring Bowen Tyler, but I didn't need to have that knowledge to enjoy these stories. The setup is that descendants of Tyler head to the area where he disappeared and find themselves in the same land of dinosaurs and savages in the same time frame, and then with Bowen Tyler himself. And the two issues of Sita the Savage tell her story, which is pretty traditional jungle warrior lady. And I enjoyed that trade quite a bit. They also sent from a few years later another team-up story, Fear on Four Worlds, 1 through 4. This is the story of Tyler's granddaughter from the first trade paperback from above, jumping through portals and landing on Venus, then on the moon, then Pellucidar, and then back to Castback. The plot reasons behind these moves between stories, between dimensions, the mechanics, that's pretty weak. And even the overall gist of the storyline, there's not a lot there. It reminded me a bit of the recent CW Crisis on Infinite Earths, where the highlights of the shows were the Easter eggs, not the actual, you know, stuff that happened in the story. And I'd say the same about this miniseries. Fun, interesting, good character bits, but not a lot actually happening. But again, weirdly, a fun read. And speaking of Edgar Rice Burroughs, from a couple of sources, for 50 cents and or 3 for a dollar, I read a bunch of Tarzan books. Tarzan of the Apes 161, that was from Gold Key. And then with the same ongoing numbering, but from DC, Tarzan of the Apes 211, 212, and 215. And then from Marvel, Tarzan Lord of the Jungle 18 through 20. The Marvel ones had a young Tarzan facing down some pirates and a fellow from Pellucidar. So that was a nice crossover among the ERB properties. And this one had a wild cast of characters, from the sea dogs, to the natives, to the English, to Tarzan, to the Middle Easterner. Although he had the unfortunate nickname, the Mad Arab. And throwing in the unusual beasts of Pellucidar, those definitely gave Tarzan plenty to do. The one Gold Key issue was a version of the Jewels of Opar story, and not the first time I've read a comic book adaptation of that story. And I have to say I did enjoy it, despite some of the art issues or other limitations that come with it being a Gold Key book. But not a bad adaptation by any means. And the DC books were solid, including a couple of one-off stories. One of those was really good, where Tarzan helps his elephant friend Tantor to avoid a trap, only to fall into it himself, and all looks lost until the elephant crashes down where he's being held. And I loved that because that's always one of my favorite parts of the old Tarzan movies, where the elephants come to the rescue. So seeing that concept, that basic scene in a comic book, that was kind of a blast. And sticking with the same era, another character with pulp origins. I read some related books that I purchased from Pulp Realities 50-cent boxes and or received from Sir Iowa's Joe. And that is the Dark Horse, Conan 3-5, and then from recent Marvel, Age of Conan, Valeria 3-4. The Dark Horse books were by Busiak, drawn by Kerry Nord, and they were very good. These issues tell the story of a young Conan, just 16 summers old, venturing for the first time beyond his native land. He is captured and enslaved by sorcerers, along with some worshippers of the Norse gods. And after scuffling with each other because comics, they join forces, and by the end of issue 5, they come very close to breaking out. I don't have the next issue, so I wish Conan and his battle mates good luck. I like the nobility that Conan shows here by not leaving the Norsemen behind, but seeing them at that stage more as battle compatriots, brothers, more than enemies or worshippers of different gods. And he does his best to set them free. Good stuff. The recent Marvel books that I read do not star Conan, but they take place in that same world or in that same era. The two issues I read were written by Meredith Finch and feature a woman with a revenge mission who has been taken in by a monastery after being quite badly injured. Good story. It felt Conan-ish, if you know what I mean. I don't know how extensive this Age of Conan concept went in Marvel, but these issues were pretty solid reads. In a different era, but a similar type of story, I suppose, from the recent Three for a Buck sale, I read three issues, featuring the last boy on Earth, Commandy, 19, 22, and 24. These are all from the Jack Kirby era of the mid-70s. And one thing that was nice is that they were all more or less standalones. There is a longer arc of Commandy wandering Earth after the Great Disaster, but each one of these stories put him in a different location, dealing with a different scenario, much like a TV show of that same era might have done. And I enjoyed all of these to varying degrees, although the one with gangsters in Chicago, that was my favorite. You did kind of have to squint sometimes for it all to make sense, but that was okay. All three of these are Kirby crazy, Kirby exciting, and Kirby crackling. Between a reprint book from Half Price Books and the contributions of the generous Canadian Sir Rob Lance, I got my Spidey on, and read Amazing Spider-Man 18, 229 and 230, Spectacular 10 and 27, and Marvel Team-Up 3. Good stuff for the most part. I enjoyed the classic story from the Ditko era with JJJ on the rampage, and the two-parter with the Juggernaut was terrific. I really enjoyed his relentlessness and Spidey trying and trying and trying to stop him. It was dramatic. It wasn't until he fell into the concrete pouring of a building foundation that he was finally stopped. It was a very tense, very dramatic story. And that one had a subplot with Madame Web, the psychic, and that added a nice counterpoint to those stories as well. Sir Rob Lance also sent in a trade paperback of stories originating in 2000 AD, making up the stories Absalon, Noblesse Oblige, and Absalon, Ghosts of London. This is similar to the Rivers of London series I've read some of, about London police specializing in supernatural affairs. This time out, our lead is Harry Absalom, and his crew enforces the Accord. And that, as you know, is the treaty made in the 1600s between the King of England and Hell. I mean, I'm not sure if your high school history class got to that part of European history, but in case not, that is what the Accord is. Now, in these two storylines, the demons get a bit out of hand, and old Harry Absalom has to bring them to heel. Good stuff. I love the concept, and the black and white art really helped tell these creepy, horror-tinged fantasy stories. And Kirk Spencer, Big Five Army, he sent me three consecutive issues of a DC series from 1999. New Gods, 2-4. I like the Kirby creations in this series from Jim Starlin and Paris Cullens. Takes Orion and Light Ray and the crew and puts them up against an empire of insects. We get Mantis and Forager and some pretty cool battle scenes. And a different view of New Genesis. Not a bad take on the Kirby creations. I am not one that minds when concepts and worlds get revisited or reinterpreted. And I thought that this particular reinterpretation, at least as far as I've read, I think it got off to a pretty good start. And from a couple of recent discount bins, I read a couple of issues featuring the greatest hero of our neighbor to the north. From 1993, Captain Canuck Reborn, number 0. And from 2015, from Chapter House, Captain Canuck, number 5. I've been kind of a fan of this character since I picked up his 1975 number 1 issue. Now, I picked it up sometime in the 80s, probably. So anytime I find issues of the Captain's title for cheap, I pick them up. The 0 issue was a 16-page preview for that particular iteration or that reboot of the character, which was envisioned as a legacy character. The recent series was more military fiction than superhero story, and I enjoyed that one quite a bit. I've read a few other issues in that series, I believe. That setup seemed familiar. And the backup in that issue, the Captain Canuck issue, was another Canadian hero that I had an issue of from way back in the day, Northgard. So that was also a pleasant surprise. Pretty enjoyable issues. And from Sir, Iowa's Joe, I read Category 0, 1, 2, and 4 from Scout Comics. In this world, about 1% of all humanity have a gene that may develop into strange new powers. And we do touch on the common X-Men type of mutant themes, hysteria, and all the powers allied against these 1%ers. But I liked a couple of the characters. There was a strong father-son relationship that were introduced to early on, and that allowed me to think of this as something other than just another anti-mutant story. So I like that. Joe also sent a trade of a series that I've heard interesting things about, Spencer and Locke, Volume 2, Issues 1 through 4. This is not officially Calvin and Hobbes All Growed Up, but it is completely presented as being Calvin and Hobbes All Growed Up. Spencer is a cop, but he works solo because he doesn't need a partner because he has the leopard called Locke as his partner. But Locke is a stuffed animal, or is he? And if that wasn't enough of a reference to you, each issue also has a comic strip version of the characters, totally in Calvin and Hobbes style. And the weirdest thing about this setup is that it, for the most part, works. The imaginary partner can easily be read as an after effect of Spencer's PTSD. And that does raise the question of who exactly is engaged in these vicious attacks on bad guys if there's not really a big jungle cat involved. The mystery plot itself is interesting, and we get Spencer's daughter in the stories as well, and that has its own bit of pathos. Very good series. It's a bit odd. It's a bit off-center, but it's very good. Sir Iowa's Joe also sent in, much to the chagrin of Stella and the approval of Dr. Ange, Robotech Remix 1 through 4, an ongoing from Titan Comics. This tells the story of a futuristic Dana Sterling sent back in time to save her past Earth. Dana is the first offspring of a human and alien couple, and her arrival in the past creates a splinter timeline in which things she remembers are still true, and some things and people and events that she remembers are not true. And it's in this remixed version of reality that she now is trying to exist. It's an interesting battle story, some good personal bits, a lot of plots and subplots. I'm not going to become a super fan right away, but Joe did send some of the Robotech novels in this care package as well, and I'm definitely going to start those over the summer. I also hoopla'd the remainder of a series I started a few years back when Sir Iowa's Joe sent me a few issues. So this month I read Descender 17 through 32, which did wrap up the series. And this one is, you just think of it as your standard boy and his dog story, except that the boy and the dog are both robots. And, well, actually, they're two robot boys, and they're on different sides of a galactic struggle. And the key is that the robots, well, actually all of machine kind, have been observing us for years, testing us, seeing how we treat machines, and we have been found wanting. So they decide to uprise against us. And here's the thing, it does not go well for us. The only hope for peace is one of these robot boys, as he contains some software code that can allow him to communicate to the robot rebels. But he also has lived his entire life around humans and can perhaps demonstrate to both sides that humankind and machine kind can live together in harmony. This series technically is wrapped up, but there's a follow-up title, Ascender, which I imagine I'll take a crack at later in the year. I talked about Derek William Crabb's care package before. Derek is, of course, from the Fanholes podcast, and he sent a bunch of old Legion of Superhero stories. I supplemented with a couple from the DC app as well, based on what issues were available over there. Overall, I read Adventure Comics 356, 357, 360, and 368 through 372. And this pack of stories contains the expected silliness, the expected oddball stories, such as the one where five legionnaires are de-aged and put into a superpowered orphanage, but also the requisite soap opera type stories as well. And there was also a really good two-parter where they go up against one of their top villains, the Wizard Mordru. Reading a lot of these in quick succession can get a bit repetitive, a bit redundant, but overall, I have thoroughly enjoyed this Legion of Superhero revisit. I know there are still a few more of these adventure comics that I've not quite gotten to yet. Derek also sent a couple of licensed Dark Horse books from 1991, Terminator, secondary objectives number 4, and then from the next miniseries that followed right along after that, Terminator, The Enemy Within, number 2. Now here's the thing. Other than those first two movies, I don't know much about the lore of the Terminator, but at least these comics were from before that world got too convoluted, and that helped with these ones, as they were tied enough to the world of the movies, the world that I was familiar with, that world that I understood, that they worked pretty well for me. Now, you know, when I'm digging through the 50-cent boxes at Pulp Reality, that I cannot resist prestige format books at that epic price of 50 cents. So I picked up from 1992 a 4-issue series written by Tom Veitch, the sci-fi series My Name is Chaos, 1-4. We have a future world where Earth is at war with itself, and planetary expeditions to Mars seem like the best solution. But someone has already been planning for that eventuality, and his superpowered mandroids are ready to colonize and take control of the planet, which necessitates a war with Earth. And behind all of this are a pair of brothers, one thought long dead, and one who is kind of a mad scientist. I love my sci-fi, and this one has enough political and corporate intrigue that made it all work for me. It certainly has its unusual elements, shall we say, but again, for me, and certainly for the price, very good pickup. And we've talked about before, if you're going to miss one part of a 3-part series, it's best to miss the middle one. So, when I saw, at those 50-cent bins, The Time Machine, number 1 and 3 of 3, from Eternity Comics, I could not resist. It helps that I'm familiar enough with the H.G. Wells story that I could fill in the missing bits from this adaptation. This was black and white, but that does not bother me at all. I've read plenty of black and white independent books from this era, so that, for me personally, is not a speed bump. They did add an additional, like, robotic character to this adaptation, and the text piece in the first issue explains that this was to eliminate the tons of narrative that's in the novel, but that wouldn't work in a comic book, so they had this new character created as a way of giving the time traveler someone to talk to, someone to bounce ideas off of, and also a way to show his character as well. So I had no problem with that, because the bulk of the story, the plot, was the same. They just made this particular concession, and certainly a few others, to the unique characteristics of what a comic book is as a form of storytelling. On Hoopla, I found a bunch of trades from Xenoscope featuring a character that Sir Iowa's Joe sent me a few issues of. So I started with the character's origin in Grimm Fairy Tales Presents Robin Hood 1-5. And that's Robin, R-O-B-Y-N, for Robin, because it's a lady. But come on. As soon as I said Xenoscope, you knew it was a lady, and that she'd be pretty, you know, pretty. It is a solid modern revenge tale, actually, with a fantasy portal element. Our heroine Robin gets sent back in time to another dimension, whatever, and takes part in the classic Robin Hood story, meeting the Merry Men, winning the archery contest, and getting pretty kill-happy on Mean King John. Then, heading back home with a little help from a woman named Marion, she heads back to her era to take her skills and experience in vengeance to wreak vengeance on the powerful men in our world who had done very, very bad things to her. I enjoyed it, and will probably jump into the next available trade sometime soon. Now, I also picked up the entire run of a series from DC from the 70s, The Joker, Clown, Prince of Crime, 1-9. other than the plot hole of not always explaining how these stories could actually occur without the Joker going back to prison every issue, that is addressed towards the end of the series, just to be clear. But other than that, these are mostly pretty good. The covers are all very good, by the way, and the stories are all wacky and weird. I like the one that had him go up against the Royal Flush Gang. Again, that one made sense with their competing motifs, shall we say. The one with Luther was not nearly as good from the 50s that I'd read in Batman from the 30s to the 70s, or possibly Superman from the 30s to the 70s. Anyway, but the best of these, no doubt, was I think it was issue 6, where the Joker went one-on-one with Sherlock Holmes. You know, sort of. I mean, not really, of course, but the story was drenched in Holmesian references, and that worked for me. And overall, a pretty enjoyable trade, I have to admit. And I wrapped up a series I started sometime last year. This one, an underwater adventure from Matt Kint, Department H, 13 through 24. A team of deep sea explorers in close quarters, and one of them murders another. The investigator is Mia, and she's the daughter of the man. She joins the crew underwater and finds much more going on, pardon the pun, beneath the surface than she expected. Also in the world above, a terrible virus is sweeping across the earth, and the team down below may have discovered a cure. But can they surface safely? And even if they can, should they? Or does stopping the virus simply extend humanity's tenure on a dying Earth? And also, what about the murderer? Can we discover the identity of that person and seek justice? There's a lot going on here, as it may sound, including a discussion of where humanity can go to live should the Earth become unlivable. There is a debate in the story between colonizing space and colonizing the bottom of the ocean. And again, among this big picture discussion and debate, which is an interesting enough sci-fi concept, we get a legitimate murder mystery and an ocean story and lots of intertwining storylines. Considering it's a very small cast of characters, that is quite a feat, actually. And I enjoyed that combo of sci-fi and mystery. It got both of those bits right enough for me. So that was an enjoyable and quite impressive work. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, the way that Department H wrapped up was very impressive. Descender was also very good. Lady Mechanica and Dr. Doom were both really, really good. Carl Banks and the Ducks are worth mentioning, of course. But in terms of which of these I thought was my favorite, which one I enjoyed the most, I really like Spencer and Locke. And the cliffhanger at the end of the first issue was great. So I'm going to go with Spencer and Locke Volume 2, Issue 1, as my favorite read of the month. Next month, I'm not really sure what I'm going to be reading at all. But whatever I do end up reading, I'll be here to talk about the books I read in March. And that episode ought to be out sometime in early April. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of the books that I mentioned here, especially if you've read any of them. You can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook or blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek. And of course, the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. All are welcome. Thanks for listening, and keep the pages turning.